Last lap.
Right, okay, thank you. Agenda paper 11. The Interpretations Committee received a request for clarification about IFRS 10, Consolidated Financial Statements. The query in this paper relates to protective rights and the effect that those rights have on power over the investee. More specifically, the submitter asks whether the control assessment should be reassessed if protective rights become exercisable on breaching of covenant, or whether protective rights can never affect an assessment of control. The submitter thinks that there are two views about what happens on breach. Either the investor reassesses the rights at that stage to see whether it still controls the investee after breach or not, or there is an alternative view that protective rights never affect the control assessment because they are designed not to give the holder power, and by definition, they don't confer power. In the stark conclusion, we think that the standard's clear that an investor must reassess whether it controls an investee whenever facts and circumstances have changed, and that the breach that resulted in the protective rights becoming exercisable was such a change. We also think that the standard doesn't include an exemption for protective rights from this need for reassessment, and that the ISB's redeliberations of this topic included an example where protective rights did change the control assessment after breach. So therefore, our conclusion and recommendation is that we don't think this topic meets the agenda criteria, because we think the standard's clear that a reassessment of control must be carried out when the facts and circumstances change. And it's unlikely that there would be significant future diversity in practice once the standard is applied because of that clarity. So the question for you on page 16 is, do you agree with that staff recommendation not to add the topic to the Interpretation Committee agenda?
Ross?
Agree.
First.
Charlotte?
I agree too. I think there are some rights that are protective, and even when the contingency is settled, they'll stay as simply protective, so your assessment won't change, but I still think you're supposed to be assessing it. And I think that's what the more interesting sort of areas, if this was in a non-operating entity, a more structured entity, where the sort of how you consider if decisions and actions in the event of a default tend to be different animals.
Peter?
I have a question. Paragraph 3, we say, or the submitter says, that the bank's rights are considered to be protective. Why is that? It seems to be that, and I need to take a step back, because some people seem to think that either rights are substantive or protective. I have a different view. If I read the standard, I would say that my understanding of the rights of the bank are not protective. They are not substantive right now because they are not currently exercisable. That's what 10b-24 tells me. And I read 10b-25 saying clearly that something can be protective and substantive if it's currently exercisable, but it's still protective. So I would come to the same conclusion as a staff, but I would say from the beginning, those are not protective rights. They are not substantive now because they are not currently exercisable. As soon as they become exercisable, then they are substantive. They have never been protective, but that's maybe...
And I think that fundamental assessment is sort of part of the heart of the substantive view, but I imagine there... referring to the guidance in B26 where it says protective rights relate to fundamental changes or apply in exceptional circumstances. And I think the fact that they're looking at these as something that are triggered by breach means that they arise in exceptional circumstances, and that's generally an attribute of a protective right.
That's a good point, because I think that's where a lot of people, not only in this fact pattern, stumble, trying to understand being protective, saying it's not substantive or not. And I see your point that B26 seems to say it's only in exceptional circumstances, then it's protective. whereas the currently exercisable notion seems to say, well, it can be substantive and protective. Depends on whether it's currently exercisable. And I think it's not something that we can address here. I think we come to the right conclusion, and I think we need to inform the board that this is an issue where a lot of people have different views on how to apply the standard. And the question at the end of the day is, the circumstances where only exceptional circumstances you can use your rights, which are not protective when they are exercised, are we in the protective camp and then go to the non-protective, or are we in the non-protective camp at the beginning? It's only not currently exercisable.
And in the paper, we have tried to discuss the difference between the relationship between substantive and protective, because it's clear in the standard, we think, that they're not mutually exclusive, and that in some cases, rights can be substantive, even if they're only exercisable in the future. So all of those three characteristics are linked, but they're not in a sort of a definitive relationship.
I agree with you, but B26 then seems to say something different. That's why people say, well,
Guido, just to make sure that I understand. I know April's up. I'm not sure. You're almost taking the opposite end of the spectrum from the view that was expressed that protective rights can never be substantive. You're kind of taking the view that all rights are substantive, but some are more substantive than others. And the degree to which, so all rights are substantive, but some don't have an effect until something happens to trigger them, is essentially what you're saying. Okay, I can understand that. Andrew?
Well, a couple of questions, really. I want to make sure I fully understood that. Is the argument there that rights that are incorporated in loan agreements with sort of breach of covenant clauses are not protective because that's not an exceptional circumstance?
I think really...
I'm not quite sure I followed Guido's argument, but it sounded quite interesting.
I mean, I think on that point, I've tried to express that in paragraph 42, is that I think protective rights by their nature must change over time and have the potential to change on breach. Because if a protective right wasn't exercisable and didn't confer any power to you at inception, how could it ever give you any protection over your asset or over your rights, unless there was some condition which caused that to change and it then became protective of your asset or of your rights. So I think that protective rights, there is always this general understanding that at the beginning it doesn't give you power, but to the extent the breach occurs and something exceptional and negative from your perspective occurs, then you do have this right to protect your asset, either by seizing the asset back or something.
But the argument for reassessment at the time the rights kick in seems to be, by that stage, they're not protective. So what was the point? I don't understand the point of them beforehand, because you would disregard them in the consolidation. I don't understand. What's the point of having protective rights if they're irrelevant only when they become non-protective?
But I think that's because we're assuming that once the breach occurs, that I don't know if you're assuming whether they do give you power or whether they don't give you power. I think what we're saying is that we don't know whether they would give you power at that stage, but that something has happened so that you do have to assess whether those exercisable rights now give you the ability to control the activities of the entity or not.
So they might still be protected.
They might not give you the ability to control the entity, or they might. And I think when we go on to look at the specific example, we say we really don't have enough information because we don't know enough about all the spectrum of rights that the bank, the entity, and perhaps other parties might have.
No, I understand. I was just trying to get it clear in my head. So if you did, the act of reassessment does not necessarily mean they're no longer protective. Is that what you're saying?
It doesn't necessarily mean that you have power or that.
So at that stage, if you reassess and decide you consolidate, they're still protective, but you're consolidating.
No. Well, not to the extent that IFRS 10 defines protective as those which do not give power. If you do your reassessment and you decide that they do give you power, then I think in terms of IFRS 10, they would become substantive and non-protective in the terms of the standard, and they would confer power.
The other question I had is that, I know we can't deal with specific facts and issues here, but there's been a lot of talk in the press over the past few months about zombie companies, which are effectively in breach of covenant and semi-comatose and ticking over, can't refinance, and sort of the lending bank is letting them tick over. If we go down this route, does that tend towards banks having to consolidate these type of companies?
Well, I think there's always the guidance in the standard that to actually be a substantive right, the entity would have to be able to act on that right and would have to be able to direct the activities of the entity.
Could, but just choose not to.
So whether or not banks have the practical ability to go and to do that, and similarly in the terms of this example, where the lender has the ability to veto the decisions of others, that may not necessarily give them power if someone else is actually making the decisions of the appropriate activities, the relevant activities of the entity.
I'm seeing more confused looks than I expected. Andrew, can I try and bring some of the additional confusion in? Charlotte?
I was actually just going to explain the sort of rights that we have that are protective, if we were a lending bank, would have. So in normal circumstances, without any default, we would have certain veto rights over business plan. I think there was a massive change in business plan, or we would have to approve a business plan before approval, which wouldn't give us a participating right, but would be protective. And that would stay protective throughout. It's an ability to stop something potentially, not an ability to proactively do something. But in the event of a default, we could then have more rights, and maybe it might be more protective rights. So, a covenant is breach, you get more things come to you for the veto, or that it kicks in a lot of participating rights, such as the ability to sell assets. And so that's the sort of range of things. I think you reassess them anyway, but if you knew up front that the rights, all your rights ever did was just have more and more protective rights, you never got participating rights, a reassessment would be a moot point. You'd never get there. I would say in a situation where I don't think it's relevant whether you've called a default, whether you've exercised that right. I think the mere fact that you have the ability to do it means actually calling it is irrelevant, and the choice not to do it is an equal choice. But you'd still have to look at the rights you would have post the default, and we do that in situations. We look at if a receiver was called in. If we can call a receiver now, if a receiver is called in, what rights does it give us, and would we be in control? The other situation is whether an entity has the situation I refer to, where prior to an event, there aren't any decisions going on in the entity. There are no substantial decisions. It's just ticking over. It's servicing some loans. Everything's happening. And then you would say, even though our rights are only contingent, the fact that we've got the only key decisions in that entity means we're controlling now, because effectively nobody else is controlling. And the only thing I would query is, I think B28, the ability of a lender to seize the assets of a borrower, I don't think that's necessarily protective. I think in the event that you're in a position of being able to do that, you'd have to reassess whether you thought that gave you control or not, because to be honest, it's something you could threaten, or you could hold that over somebody and they would probably do what you wanted to do if you could seize all their assets, and we would take that into account. But that's going to be my interpretation of it.
Bert?
Well, I think what Charlotte said helped me a little bit understand the difference between substantive and protective, because before that, to me, the whole discussion seemed a bit artificial, because either I consolidate or I don't consolidate. If I call the right non-substantive or protective, to me, does not make much difference if I don't have to consolidate. But obviously, in a case where you have a veto right, for business decisions that is considered a protective right, this is a substantive right, right? So a substantive right, but still a protective right.
That's
so
right.
You don't consolidate. But that's the difference. You actively control parts of the decisions, but you still not consolidate because you consider them protective. Before the breach, because after the breach you consolidate.
After the breach you don't.
That's on the taxes.
Okay, first in, first out principle. John, Scott, Guido, and...
I mean, it seems to me that B26 identifies two types of examples of protective rights, all the related fundamental changes to the activities, or those that apply in exceptional circumstances. It seems that the latter, those that apply in exceptional circumstances, are usually subject to some trigger event, which actually, to me, changes your rights, or gives you additional rights to the protective right that you have. It's those additional rights you're actually assessing whether they're substantive rights or not that give you control, and sometimes they will, and sometimes they won't. The first type of protective right, those that are more that are related to fundamental changes to the activities of the investee, are usually continued. They're not usually ones that are subject to some trigger that provides you with additional rights. That's how I tend to think about the relationship between protective rights and substantive rights. They're no longer protective. You know, the original right was protective, but once the trigger occurs, you're getting additional rights that you have to assess whether those are substantive rights or new protective rights themselves.
Scott?
I agree with the staff paper. The discussion, as you've suggested, Wayne, has been making me more confused instead of less. Substantive rights are defined as those that you have the practical ability to exercise. So a substantive right could give you power, could not give you power, could be protected, could not be protected. As long as you have the practical ability to exercise, it's substantive, and that decides whether you take it into account in your consolidation analysis or not. A right that the party doesn't have the practical ability to exercise, you just completely ignore. That's out. Then, in assessing the substantive rights, then I think you have to take a look at whether the substantive rights held by you, held by others, all in, give you the power over the relevant activities. And protective rights come in only in trying to think about whether a substantive right held by others, because if it's not substantive, you're ignoring it completely, whether a substantive right held by somebody else prevents you from having power over the relevant activities. And the guidance in B26 says that substantive rights held by others that are only protective do not stop you from having power, whereas substantive rights held by others that are more than protective might stop you from having power. And that those rights don't have to give the other party power to stop you from having power. Because if they have veto rights over relevant activities, then you don't have power, you don't consolidate. Did I track that through correctly, April?
I'm not sure about the last statement, but if someone else has veto rights, you don't consolidate.
Well, let me read that. I am reading B25. As long as the rights are not merely protected, substantive rights held by other parties may prevent the investor from controlling the investee, even if the rights give the holders only the current ability to approve or block decisions.
They may.
They may.
Well, they don't necessarily.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. But if they if they can approve or block decisions over relevant activities, that seems to circle back to the general definition of power. So, I mean, I agree with what others have said. Substantive rights, protective rights, they're related to each other, but they're not mutually acceptable, mutually disparate categories. It's not that your right is either substantive or protective. In fact, if it's not substantive, you're done. It's just gone. You no longer think about it anymore. So if I'm reading that correctly, then I think the staff analysis is the way that I would have thought about it as well. Okay.
Guido, and Andrew, and then I'm going to try and put a rhythm on this.
Am I on? No,
there you go.
So I agree with what Scott has said. My first view would be, is it substantive or not? And one of the important things B25 tells me it can only be, well, it has to be currently exercisable, otherwise I have to have the practical ability, but it's, if it's not currently exercisable, I don't have the ability, and so it's substantive. So, but we still, and that's why we got this submission. If it would be so easy, we wouldn't have got this submission. Because the problem is that then, I think it's B26 says, it's one of the situations where something is protective is when it's only applicable in exceptional circumstances. And there is the collision between, you know, is something currently exercisable? No, it may not be currently exercisable. Then it's not substantive, but it may be that it's not protective.
Mm-hmm.
It's not substantive, but it's not protective, especially in situations where the veto right relates to relevant activities. And that's the case in our fact pattern, as I understand it. So if our answer to the submitter would be, it's not a protective right, it's not substantive. And it becomes substantive as soon as it's exercisable, and then you need to you may have to control, because B15D tells you that a veto to relevant activities might give you power. So I still think that we need to look at there seems to be some confusion in the standard. Some people say if it's only exercisable in exceptional circumstances, it's a protective right. That's what B26 tells you. Others would say, no, it's not a protective right. It's a right to veto relevant activities, so it's not a protective right. It's just not substantive if I can't exercise it currently.
I think
others, just to make it a little bit more complicated, would look at B13 and say, oh, wait a minute, there are relevant activities at different points in time, depending on a contingency that might happen or not. And at the beginning, you need to think about who of the two parties, the bank or the other one in our circumstance, has control. Or maybe they have control at different points of time. So I can understand that the submitter says, well, it's a protective right from the beginning, why would that change? I still think there is some confusion in the standard that we need to resolve. What is the relationship between being something currently exercisable,
I think,
that being substantive, or something that is only.
All right.
I wonder if we're making this an awful lot more complicated than it needs to be. Isn't the fundamental question, to paraphrase Scott, step one, evaluation is continuous. Step two, stuff happens.
Sorry?
And stuff.
Stuff happens.
Technical term, things happen.
Events occur.
And that changes the basis on which you either include or exclude rights from this continuous assessment. And so it may be that something that you excluded from last month's assessment because an event happened, you would now include in this month's assessment. And the labels actually aren't very important at that point. And
I think the important thing we're trying to decide is, do you have power? Because that's one of the three elements of control.
Right.
And the terms substantive or protective or exercisable are not definitive, not one of those equals power. They are all components that you would look at. So for example, I think one of your first statements was that you believe that to give power, the right has to be currently exercisable. But that would not necessarily be the case. I think Charlotte mentioned there is a case where if the only relevant activity of a financing entity or something is to monitor debtors in, you know, whenever a breach occurs, or to settle debtors whenever a breach occurs. If that's the only relevant activity, the fact that that right's not exercisable now doesn't mean that they may not be the people who control it. And similarly for other things about the characteristics of right. In the implementation guidance, we've tried to give some of the characteristics that you would take into that assessment of power. But I think the fundamental thing is you're looking to see who has power over the entity, and that would be the basis of your control assessment.
Today.
Yeah, and that would be reassessed if any of those characteristics or conditions change.
Just one question to you then. Is the assessment in paragraph 3 correct that if under certain circumstances you can block relevant activities, that this is a protective right?
You could.
It could be protective, it could be more than protective. It depends when you can block the relevant activities.
But I understood that this is not the relevant question at all. If it's not substantive, then we don't have to care whether it's protective or not.
I think if it's not substantive, we ignore it because the other party has no ability to exercise it. So Guido actually read the first sentence of B25 different than I did. The sentence says, substantive rights exercisable by other parties can prevent an investor from controlling. I think Guido read that as to say that if a right isn't currently exercisable, it is not substantive. I don't think that's what it says. I think you evaluated in B22, whether the right is substantive or not. Do they have a practical ability? If they do, it's substantive and you consider it. If they don't, you're done, you ignore it. Having concluded the right is substantive, you then need to think about what B25 says, is that rights that other parties can exercise can prevent you from controlling. Right, to be substantive, rights need to be exercisable, this is B24, when decisions about the direction of the relevant activities need to be made. And that was getting back at what April said. If the only relevant activity is something that hasn't happened yet, then the fact that the right isn't currently exercisable is irrelevant. Because as long as it will be exercisable when the relevant decision needs to be made, it would still not be protective and possibly be substantive as long as the counterparty has the ability to exercise.
Well, that's not the case in this fact, though.
Andrew,
not in this case, you're on a different
case. Just from a practical perspective, if I understood Charlotte correctly, I think you said at stage when you can participate in the decisions, for example, directing asset sales, then that's a sort of important event in the reassessment, and you might well consolidate at that stage. I can understand that, but the paper also says we wouldn't expect much diversity here, and I'm not sure that's correct. And therefore, whatever we say, we need to be clear on our logic, because I think it's a very important issue.
Peggy?
When I was looking at this, I just thought of it as a continuous assessment, and that there can be certain triggering events that could change that assessment, and you don't know what they are, because you did, you know, at the beginning, but it's always looking and a continuous assessment, and then being aware of triggering events that can change from participating to substantive.
I think that's the essence of what Scott was saying, and I think what I was saying. Charlotte?
Yeah, I was just going to come back with what Andrew said. I said, we've seen variety in practice. We've seen people who think that because a right has only become theirs when it's the default, you should never consider, even though that right gives them full control over the company, the fact they got it through a default of a loan means that they should, they should consider. And interestingly, that's actually not coming from the parents, but the big four. So it's a different, that's where that difference in opinion. Yeah. And I think that's where the area of concern here is how do you look at rights which are participating in nature, non-protective in nature, but which are contingent? I think that's the big question that people have. Not on rights that are protective either side of a contingency, because that sort of, it doesn't really matter which order you look at it in that case. It's ones that are substantive, would be participating when they happen.
John, and then let's see if there's a way to wrap this up.
I think just coming back to the core question, it seems to me that paragraph 8 is quite clear that it's the facts and circumstances need to be continually reassessed. And therefore, whether as time goes by, different rights actually change relative to each other, depending upon the occurrence of events that might trigger those protective rights, whether they were classed originally as protective or substantive or whatever is sort of irrelevant because you're doing a continuous reassessment of the impact of those rights on power. Because paragraph A says investors can reassess whether it controls an investee if facts and circumstances indicate that there are changes to one or more of the three elements of control.
Yeah.
There's clearly changes to power if direct rights of the parties involved in the entity get their rights trigger the exercise or additional power or rights that come to them from their involvement in the entities.
Just a quick remark about the potential for diversity in practice. It might well be that from the point of view of the investor who has lost power, if he assesses that the rights now are such important in terms of relevant activity that he's losing power and he would need to consolidate or stop consolidation, it might be there is not much diversity in practice to be observed. Where I'm expecting to see a lot of diversity in practice is in the bank's financial statements for the consolidation, whether the banks will do the opposite assessment, I mean the mirror assessment of saying I've got now enough power vis-a-vis that entity and I need to consolidate. And that, I think we will see a lot of diversity if we are not here.
That brings me to, I guess, a question that was tickling me a little bit. It would seem to me, and I'll ask Alan to confirm that, you might have a situation in which you assess that you no longer have control. If I'm correct, Alan, it does not follow that somebody else does. Okay, he's saying I'm correct. So I may reach a conclusion that I no longer have control of this subsidiary. Actually, I don't honestly care at that point if somebody else does, because I lost it. But somebody else looking at the same facts and circumstances might say, well, yeah, I took it away from Michael, but that doesn't mean I got it. It just means I took it away from him. Bernd?
But what if it's the other way around? If both come to the conclusion that they have control?
One is wrong.
One of them is wrong, right?
Yeah, Ron's is correct. The correct answer is one of them is wrong.
Yeah, but so it's mutually exclusive, so they cannot both consolidate.
Yes.
That's correct. The standard says that.
Sorry, but wait. This your analysis that if one no longer controls, does it mean that the other one, now controls, I think it's problematic because there are only two parties vis-à-vis that entity, the former investor, the investor who has just control, and the bank, for whom the objective assessment of the facts and circumstances tell that now they control the relevant activities. The veto rights are so important that we concluded that we no longer control the investor, and now on the bank, through the veto rights, has control. How will it be that we will accept that the bank will not consolidate from that point? Is the same criteria applied for both losing control and getting control?
I think if it's only a two-player game, you may be right.
Or they could be joint control.
It's a two-player game. You have investor, 100%, and the bank.
Two possibilities. They have joint control, in which case neither consolidates. Or, more likely, there are three players, or four, or five. There's also preferred shares, there's also something else.
The fact pattern, 100% is owned by one entity.
I think one of April's arguments for saying we don't know enough about the second half is that we don't know what other players there are and what other rights there are. And so it would be inappropriate to answer it in this limited framework.
Yes, and all the relevant activities, what they are.
Yeah, we just don't know enough. Okay, we
should have sent it to us.
You really want to keep talking about this, Cheryl?
No.
We lose the webcast at 1:30.
Okay, we lose the webcast in 10 minutes, so at any point, we have to stop then. So we'll continue the conversation and then we'll decide what to do in 5 minutes. Andrew?
Well, just to observe that I know this fact pattern started off with a 100% subsidiary or an operating entity, all owned by one entity investor, but I mean, from the bank's perspective, it's also relevant for companies that aren't controlled by anybody to start with.
Yeah.
So it's not just a question of losing control, gaining control. The issue from the bank's perspective is it's going to be the same in any circumstances, and that's where I would be concerned that, especially as this is a new standard, that there could well be diversity in practice.
Guido?
Just want to make sure that I haven't seen the agenda decision yet, so whatever. Anyway, just want to make sure that we include something in there. And I can understand the submitter. When I read the defined terms for protective rights, and we say this is a protective right, and protective right is something that doesn't give you power, that's a definition. Part of the protective rights in B26 is only on exception circumstances. Now that these exceptional circumstances have occurred, do we flip from protective rights to participating rights? I would say yes, but I think the standard is not clear. It would be better to say, well, they have not been substantive at the beginning, and now things have changed and you have to look at it again. I can understand people saying, if it has been protective at the beginning, why does that change now that these exceptional circumstances happen? And I can understand that by reading B26 and so on. So we have to make sure that we are not saying if you are in protective rights, that will be all the time a protective right. And maybe it would be much better to say this right has not been substantive, and now it becomes substantive. So I still don't think that the standard is so crystal clear that everybody would come up with the same solution.
Laurence and John, the clock stops ticking, so.
Trying to respond to you. At the beginning, make your assessment to conclude the rights are protected. That is, they will come in when exceptional circumstances take. So, at the beginning, the protected rights, you don't consolidate, you don't. Now the exceptional circumstances happen, and you have new rights. The only thing that this paper is saying is at this point in time, you have to do a reassessment of all the rights you have in order to assess whether or not you have control. So it's not the fact that you decided that at the beginning these were protective rights that would lead you all through the exceptional circumstances to conclude that they were just, it's just the fact that they were protective rights that would lead you to say, we'll never control. So basically, what this paper is saying only is you may identify at the beginning that these are protective rights. When the exceptional circumstances happen, you are required to make an assessment of your rights in order to assess whether now you have control or not.
I agree with the paper.
John, last call. Absolutely, last call.
I mean, I don't see any confusion in the standard at all. I think it's. To me, it seems crystal clear that you have to continuously reassess the three elements of control, and therefore, the fact that you put rights into particular buckets at the beginning is relevant for the beginning, but it's not relevant 1 minute past the beginning because you have to continually reassess the rights. So, and I would be very concerned if the committee was to take a view that the standard was somehow unclear on this issue, and that continuous assessment wasn't required, and that one whole category of rights was decided it didn't need to be continued to be relooked at.
We do not have an agenda decision before us. Am I correct in that?
No, we don't.
So this has to come back next time.
Okay.
It having been so much fun this time. What I would suggest, I have heard, and I thought John gave a pretty good summation, that reassessment is continuous. The things you include in reassessment will change over time as the relative positions of parties change. And that ought to be the guiding principle of our agenda decision, that we cannot envision a circumstance in which something that somebody thought was important enough to put in an agreement would be universally ruled out. Is So the idea that something just because it's labeled protective today does not, world without end, taint it. So there may, as I say, you have to continuously assess on that basis. And that will be how we write this up. I noticed that April and Michael have been taking detailed notes, and we'll try to address some of the concerns as well when we bring this back to you next time around. That said, we were scheduled to adjourn at 5:30. I would be more than happy to do that, unless somebody really wants to do the admin session yet tonight. And I think, does Patrick plan to join us tomorrow?
Yes.
He was unable to get a plane out of wherever he was coming from.
I
don't believe that. Okay. I will need to check. Your stars are blocked by the snow.
Yeah.
Still blocked?
Yeah. Your stars are still blocked. Cancellations this morning. He's going to arrive at 5 or 6, so he's
going to
come.
Okay. Well, then you'll be Iosco all by yourself.